Suite in C, Opus 53, the Leningrad Philharmonic, was conducted by Alexander Dmitriev. And that's it for Sunday Morning this week. I hope you'll join me again. The same time, that's me, Rob Cowan, next Sunday at 9 o'clock.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is made by Perfectly Normal Productions for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 12 midday now, and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Aminata Fauna is the much-lauded creator of three books to date. The Devil That Danced on Water was published in 2002 and was, I suppose, a search for the truth surrounding her father's imprisonment in 1974 in Sierra Leone when Aminata was 10. A year later he was killed. Ancestor Stones, which appeared in 2006, follows the lives of four women and also celebrates the power of stories, old and new. The Memory of Love is Aminata's most recent novel, and I think for me it certainly revolves very much around a sense of loss, and actually, in one way, even the premonition of loss.
In countries where there's been a war, where terrible things have happened, I notice this rise of nostalgia that people constantly talk about before. You know, before the war, before these things happen. But they never really have to explain what the before is. Everybody understands. But I think also when a country is heading towards war, there are those little signposts along the way. And those people who are attuned to the movements of history see them coming. So, yes, there is almost this premonition of loss.
But also in terms of love, I was very fascinated by that idea, which almost in the first couple of pages you talk about, that very often what people call first love, first seeing someone, is strangely not about lust or even real love, but it is sometimes a premonition of loss, that this is something which is unattainable.
I think that's true. It was a man who told me that, and he said that when a man looks at a beautiful woman passing in the street, you know, he isn't feeling lust, he's feeling loss. And I thought, oh, actually, it's not that different the other way round. If a woman sees a very elegant man, she feels the same thing, that actually she'll never have him. He might be 10, 15 or 20 years younger than you. So I think that friend of mine absolutely put his finger on it. It is this sense of something you'll never have. And I think we have that quite a lot, don't we, as we get older. All the things we'll never be, you know, I'll never be a concert pianist. You know, I may never travel to China. You know, one moves through life losing things and letting go of things all the time.
How much has music coloured your life?
I love music. I'm a dancer. So I love music to dance to. I'm the sort of person who puts music on in the kitchen and dances and cooks at the same time. So I've had a very sort of, you know, a popular approach to music. I came to classical music really when I started to write, when I started to face those very long, very quiet days, and I wanted something to fill that space. When you write, it's impossible to listen to anything with lyrics in it because you're dealing with words, so the words jar against each other. What you need is something that is without any words at all. And also because I have discovered that classical music really helps me to get into what writers call the zone. You know, it helps me. I mean, partly it's creating a mood to write, but also there are certain pieces that can completely almost act like a sort of hypnosis for me. I mean, I can procrastinate like all writers. I can procrastinate endlessly. And when I have got fed up with myself for doing that, I can put on certain pieces of music and they will really kind of help me get into the mood to write and get me going.
And the piece you've chosen to begin
is Bach. It's the Andante from the Italian Concerto.
And this piece does that for you?
This piece is my first choice when I'm trying to get into the mood to write. I only have to hear the first few notes of the first movement, and it's really like a kind of hypnosis. Things fall away and I have the mood, almost always.
I'll lend you my pencil in a moment. There's something very calming and structured about that, which I could see could be quite helpful to create the right mood.
A professional pianist once said to me, you can't do anything else when you listen to Bach but listen to Bach. I can write when I listen to Bach, but I can't do anything else at all.
But you see, I think for a professional musician, listening to Bach, or indeed listening to most music, is rather like listening to words would be like for you. In other words, we can't help but analyse it. I can't help thinking, oh, he's flattened the third there rather magically.
Ah, you see, all it does to me is make me completely calm and peaceful. And it removes all the other thoughts, you know, the emails I haven't done, the, you know, the wash that hasn't been put on. And actually, I can just go into another place with it and think about the music and start thinking about story. But not think about that flattened third, no.
Well, particularly beautifully played there by Alfred Brendel, very, very sensitive. The Andante from the Italian Concerto in F, BWV 971, by Bach. You went to school in Malvern, which, of course, is Elgar country, Aminata.
Yes, I spent many years there. I went to school 11, left at 18, so I was there for 7 years. I have very fond memories of Malvern. In fact, I go back occasionally to the hills, to my old school, Malvern Girls College. I was introduced to Elgar at Malvern because, of course, the school was very proud of that heritage, and particularly because Miss Elgar was one of our... I think she was his great niece, but she was one of our music teachers, so there was a great sense of Elgar when I was at school.
And it's interesting, given you, the various influences you've had in your life, do you subscribe to that feeling that a certain kind of music has a location to it, that that music could come from that kind of part of the world? Or is that fanciful?
Gosh, although I was introduced to Elgar when I lived in Malvern, does listening to Elgar now bring me back? No, not necessarily. In fact, the piece that I've chosen that we're going to listen to, I recently discovered was actually composed in Sussex and not Malvern at all.
That's right. Yes, yeah. But this was useful for a particular moment in The Memory of Love, wasn't it, this piece?
That's right. I was working up to the resolution of a love affair. I won't say which way it goes because that would give away the story. But it was going to be a very passionate moment in the book. I had some trepidation about writing it because so much of the book had brought us to this point. I was avoiding it for quite a while, actually, to be honest. I also had that impetus that you get when you're writing and you can see the horizon. You know, I do get very absorbed in it at the same time as dreading it. So this piece I happened to be listening to one day, quite by chance. I think it must have just come on the radio. And I felt this was the piece that I wanted to write that scene to. I happened to have a recording of it in the house. I don't know who was playing the piece on the radio. It's very much associated with Jacqueline Dupré, which is probably the first time I heard it, you know, probably when I was a teenager. The particular recording I had is Julian Lloyd Webber. And so I listened to it over and over again. In fact, actually, when I'm writing, you really don't want to be in the house with me because I'll simply listen to the same piece over and over again until I've got what I want from it. We were talking about whether a particular piece had an association with a sense of place and whether it really evoked it or we imagined it. And while I was listening to that, I remember reading that Elgar had actually composed it after a life-threatening illness, that he'd come out of a short coma, certainly a state of unconsciousness, with the melody in his mind, and he had composed it from that. I was listening to it and thinking about the scene that I wrote, which actually also drew on themes of life and death. Somebody is trying to save somebody else's life. I thought that perhaps that was far more evoked than, you know, Sussex or Malvern.
But there is also, I think, in that piece, you know, we were talking about a loss, a sense of loss, and rather as with Strauss and Metamorphosen, Elgar is in a sense saying farewell to an age that he knew was disappearing. You know, he was very much an Edwardian gentleman, and, you know, the world that he knew was being destroyed and was never going to be the same again, I think.
Well, it certainly has that feel. At that point when the rest of the strings come in, I almost want to cry every time I listen to it. Yes, it is full of the sense of loss.
Julian Lloyd Webber was playing the cello with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Yehudi Menuhin, in the first movement from the Cello Concerto in E minor, Opus 85, by Elgar. Now, one or two things come together rather nicely for us in the next piece, Aminata, because this is also connected, strangely enough, with a character in your recent book. But it's also to do with your own life and what you actually experienced.
I love New Orleans. It's one of my favourite cities in the States. And I was introduced to jazz in New Orleans through Michael White. I'd always sort of liked the sound of traditional jazz, of that kind of New Orleans jazz, but never really, I felt a bit distanced from it. I felt like I didn't really understand it, and it was all a bit remote for me. And I went to the States on a Harkness Fellowship, which is effectively a reverse road. You spend a year there. I was at Berkeley in California. Went down to New Orleans and went to this wonderful, I suppose you'd call it illustrated lecture by Michael White, where he introduced us to all the elements of jazz, the different instruments. And then at one point he said, you know, well, that's how it works. But of course, if it was just that, it wouldn't be jazz. Mm. And they began to play. And of course, so much of it is about improvisation.
Jamming.
So, yeah, I've loved jazz, particularly that kind of New Orleans jazz, ever since then. I was inspired by that experience to make one of my characters in The Memory of Love a musician, a clarinetist, which is Michael White is a clarinetist. And I wrote, yeah, she's a clarinetist. And there's a scene where the man who is on the brink of love for her, goes to a bar in post-war Freetown to hear the band play.
Shall we hear that extract? That'd be rather nice to get a flavour of the book itself.
Three men and a woman come onto the stage. It is her. Adrian closes his lips, misses a breath and inhales deeply with the next. A dress of the same print as the men's shirts is wrapped around her body. Her shoulders are bare, her hair pulled back from her face. She doesn't go to the microphone stand as he expects, but crosses the stage and picks up the clarinet. One of the group steps forward to the microphone and begins to hum ascending notes. The sound is immense, reverberating through the density of bodies. Minutes, it seems, pass. The sound grows louder. Then enters the clarinet, finally the guitar and the keyboard. But it is the clarinet, so close in sound to the human voice, that rises above the others. The man in the lead shifts his footing to lean closer to the microphone and begins to sing. Afterwards, Adrian would struggle to describe to himself the sort of music it was, whether jazz or soul, only the mood of it. It slows his heartbeat, his spirit is lifted and carried along on it, only to be set down and lifted again. Nobody dances, just listens. As each song finishes, the sound of the last chord hangs in the air above the heads of the audience, is dispelled only by the sound of clapping. The band moves from one song to the next, three songs in all. He watches her throughout, the sharp point of her elbow, the movement of her wrist and fingers, the way she rests the mouthpiece on her lower lip. Her playing is unostentatious, devoid of showmanship. She does not close her eyes or sway, just the heel of a foot counting beats upon the wooden floor. ¶¶ what I think, you see. I listen to that, and also because it's a live recording, it makes it feel even more so that jazz is like listening to somebody tell a story. It's like the oral tradition, and the 19th century classical form, what we call classical music, is much more like a novel. You know, somebody has written it all down. But nevertheless, there are still gaps for interpretation, even when you have written the most word-perfect short story or novel that you can. Nevertheless, your reader brings to it their own interpretation.
In fact, playing on that was Michael White, who you knew.
Well, who I met in New Orleans, and who, tragically, the last time I saw Michael White was on a documentary about Hurricane Katrina, and he had lost everything. He'd lost his home, his collection of music and instruments. It was really a tragedy, but I believe he's still playing.
Well, he was playing clarinet and Steve Pistorius the piano, and that was a Louis Armstrong Jelly Roll Morton number, Wild Man Blues. You also love ballet.
I do love ballet, and ballet was probably my initial introduction to classical music. I went to a rather curious prep school in Surrey, and our headmaster was a great fan of opera. And from the age of 6 or 7, even, I was going to operas. And I must have seen everything by the time I was 11. But I never really took to the operatic voice. It was ballet that really made me love classical performance and also music. I was remembering when I first heard this, I had snuck out of boarding school and run down to London. I had a ticket to watch Rudolf Nureyev dance Romeo and Juliet with the English National Ballet. And this is the Prokofiev score. I went off to the Coliseum and I watched him dance. The particular piece is the Dance of the Capulets, which introduces, in fact, Juliet. But it's an extraordinary piece because actually, there's nothing. I mean, when you listen to it, it to me is very threatening and almost militaristic piece of music. And if you watch it in performance, as the dancers are performing in the Kenneth MacMillan choreography, I don't know if you know it, but I mean, they're across the stage and they are in rows and they are advancing on the audience. So it is full of foreboding and it does have this military
feel. And of course, the Montagues and the Capulets are at each other's throats, aren't they?
Exactly. So it sets up musically and in dance a whole idea of this terrible feud between them.
It's fantastically suggestive music, isn't it?
It's very sinister. I feel quite threatened, actually.
Well, to start off with, there are those chords at the beginning, which for a score which is essentially tonal, diatonic, are kind of almost atonal clusters. It's just sort of a group of notes which really rub against each other quite terrifyingly. And then you get that oom-ba, oom-ba. Mm. And then the flute is almost sinister, doing those little arpeggios.
I'm not quite sure I hear the flute in that way. I think because I know the choreography, that's Juliet.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, coming in with her nurse. So she's the individual, the girl child, who will ultimately be brought down by this warlike feud between the two families.
But it seemed to me there's something even slightly glassy about that, which... So it's interesting the way music, you know, speaks in different ways to different people. The Montagues and Capulets from the Romeo and Juliet Ballet Suite, Opus 64, by Prokofiev, the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Ephraim Kurz. Tell me a little bit, Aminata, about the music that surrounded Sierra Leone and the music of Africa. Well, there isn't a sort of classical tradition in quite the same way, but there's music which is vibrantly wonderful from that area.
There's not a sort of grand, you know, 19th century classical tradition, but there is what I'd call classical music, which is music that is played to a particular structure that has to be played in a particular way that has travelled through centuries. The music that I grew up with, that I know best, it is the music of the bubu. And the bubu is a flute, a bamboo flute. And in fact, in my family's village, which is called Robonko in the middle of Sierra Leone, we have a particularly talented group of bubu players who travel the country playing for weddings and all kinds of major events. And when you are in the village and the bubu are to play that night, they don't play till after dark, and we get these wonderful pitch-black African nights. I mean, the sun simply turns off at 7 o'clock. Mm. And the bubu players start from way, way, way out of the village, and then you will hear in the moonlight the first strains of the flute starting, and they walk towards the village. There will be maybe 10 players, each playing a different note. And then as they come towards the village, then the drums will begin and the music really starts. But it is a wonderful, eerie, not the sort of music that's normally associated with West Africa at all. Yeah. It really is music to listen to.
So what have you brought in the absence of that, precisely?
I've brought a piece by Ali Fakatouri, who is quite well known to Western audiences. And he's probably the greatest exponent of what I'd call the West African classical form. He played something called Njerka, which is a one-string bowed instrument. We have them also in Sierra Leone because they're usually played by the Fula or Fulani people, and they, of course, are the nomadic people. So we hear that also in Sierra Leone. And there's something quite interesting, which is that Ali Fakatouri was frequently frustrated that people thought that his influences came from the south of America, when, in fact, of course, it was the other way round. The music of the Deep South was influenced by the enslaved Africans who came from West Africa.
Thank you. In many ways, it's a wonderful reminder of the fact that less is more. You know that when you see children in Africa or India who are not exposed to the kind of masses of expensive toys that Western children are, and they have such a wonderful time with stones and bits of wood. And in a sense there, I'm not saying that that's necessarily everything that one should desire for children, but there you have musicians working with single string instruments, quite simple drums, and making a wonderful sound.
Mm. I mean, I could only discern two instruments there, the drums and the injerka.
I heard the calabash and the congas.
Right.
As well as Ali Fakhtouri. Raikouda produced the album and played on lots of the tracks, but not on that particular one. So that was Sega, which I think is a grass snake.
Oh, I don't know.
Yes,
is that right?
So it's a grass snake, and it's a composition by Ali Fakhtouri, who was playing the injerka. And as I say, Hanuma Sakare is playing the calabash and Uma Toure the congas. I think the next music we're going to hear, Aminata, manages to marry a couple of things that you particularly love.
It does. You see, there's my love of dance, and I love flamenco, the Spanish traditional dance. I also love tango. I love church music. When I was writing The Devil That Danced on the Water, which was about my father and his life and death, it was very painful writing, and I used to go and listen to concerts and churches quite a lot, really, just to recover my equilibrium. Very peaceful music. I came across this piece by this composer, Rodrigo Leao, a Portuguese composer, and he marries the music of the flamenco, some tango rhythms, and also this kind of overlay of wonderful church music.
So are you a creature that veers wildly from the sacred to the profane?
I'm not going to answer that.
That was Ave Mundi by Rodrigo Leao. Well, we're going to finish, Aminata, with another Russian romantic. We've had Prokofiev, and now Tchaikovsky, which, if anything, is even more full-blooded.
It's true. I'm a sucker for the Russian romantics. Actually, this takes us right back to the beginning of our conversation, Michael, because we're talking about using music to get me writing. This is a piece that I listen to if I am stuck, you know, when you have those not grand moments of writer's block, but one is sort of constantly slightly blocked at different times. And this one I found very rousing. It sort of gets me to my seat and gets me going.
And of course it combines the piano of the opening piece with the orchestra that we heard earlier, because it's a piano concerto, number one in B flat minor. And this is the third movement. And is there something too about the piano pitted against the orchestra which attracts you?
That attracts me a great deal, actually. The single instrument with the orchestra behind it. And the first movement sort of comes in with this kind of great rousing sound, and then a much quieter second movement, and then back again to this vivacious third movement.
Thank you.
You see, as a writer, I'm insanely jealous of one man's ability to do that, to bring all those hours of work at the coalface together in this amazing performance that changes the emotions of 500 people listening to it.
That was the third movement from the Piano Concerto No. 1 in B-flat minor, Opus 23, by Tchaikovsky. And we heard Andras Schiff playing the piano with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir George Scholte. Are you working on another orchestral piece then, in that form? I mean, have you got an idea for your next book?
My next book, if the last one was orchestral, which it was, with different voices coming together, this one, I suppose, is a solo. It's a one instrument piece. It's a single voice. Actually, I've left Africa and moved to a different country, this time to the Balkans. And it's, I hope, a simple narrative. I've returned to the theme of war again, which I think is perhaps why I'm so attracted to these Russian composers. That theme remains a constant for me. I'm fascinated by what brings people to war, but it's a different mood of work.
And meanwhile, you've managed to achieve other little things in your life, or not so little either, like helping to build a school in your village.
That's right, actually. I do a lot of work with my family village in Sierra Leone. We've built a school. Well, the village built the school. My husband and I helped them. We have a small trust and a number of people who help us support the school. But also on different levels, we've distributed mosquito nets. We've dug a couple of wells so there's proper sanitation. We're now working on a maternal health centre, which is being built because Sierra Leone has one of the highest maternal death rates in the world. So that work continues.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for introducing us to your musical passions too.
Thank you very much indeed.
Aminata Fauna was talking to Michael Barclay, and next week at the same time, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be Simon Moore, whose novel The Glass Room was shortlisted for the 2009 Booker Prize. Private Passions is a Classic Arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
The prom season may be over, but the show-stopping performances continue all year round on BBC Radio 3. Classical performances from across the UK and beyond, every weeknight. Continuing with Wagner from the 2011 Manchester International Festival. Die Walküre, with a cast including experienced Wagner performers Susan Bullock and Susan Bickley, and the Halle Orchestra, conducted by Mark Elder. Three acts over two nights, Tuesday and Wednesday, on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news read by John Shea.
The Liberal Democrats at their annual conference in Birmingham have been focusing on ways of making sure that the rich pay what Nick Clegg called their fair share of tax. The Deputy Prime Minister has insisted that the 50 pence top rate of tax will stay unless it's replaced by a different levy on the highest earners and there's more help for the low paid. Within the last half hour, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, has told the conference that the coalition government is to create 2,000 more tax inspectors to target the 350,000 wealthiest people in the UK. A suspected burglar has been stabbed to death at a house in Stockport in Greater Manchester. A man who was inside the property at the time has been arrested on suspicion of murder. Twins who were born joined at the head have been separated by doctors in London. The 11-month-old girls, who are from Sudan, underwent four operations at Great Ormond Street Hospital. Prayers have been said at churches in South Wales for the four men who died in an accident at a coal mine in the Swansea Valley. Prince Charles is to become the royal patron of an appeal fund set up yesterday to help the families. The appeal has so far raised £20,000. The Russian billionaire Alexander Lebedev, who owns the Independent newspaper, has been involved in a brawl with a fellow panellist during a Russian television debate on the global financial crisis. TV footage shows Mr. Lebedev landing a punch on the face of another businessman, Sergei Polonsky. Around 54,000 people have been taking part in Britain's biggest mass participation road race, the Great North Run. Among those running the half marathon between Newcastle and South Shields was Emma Egging, the widow of Flight Lieutenant John Egging, who was killed while flying with the Red Arrows last month. The eight aircraft flew in missing man formation above the start line just before the race. And the weather, it'll be a bright afternoon for most parts, punctuated with a few short, sharp showers. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 2 minutes past one.
And it was read by John Shea. Time now on Radio 3 for today's early music show, which again focuses on King George III in the week of the 250th anniversary of his coronation. Here's Catherine Bott.
Hello and welcome to the second of our programmes about a much maligned British monarch, Farmer George, the Mad King. If you caught the first show, you'll know that I'm hoping to re-spin the prevailing image of King George III of the House of Hanover by looking at some of the wonderful things he and his wife, Queen Charlotte, left for us to enjoy today. Most kings leave monuments in stone, most leave their heirs with financial headaches, and George was no exception, but the royal patronage of music and the arts in his reign can only be called a blessing nearly 200 years after his death. In yesterday's programme, I went on an imaginary walk through Georgian London. Today, a very real visit to look at the treasures of the Royal Music Library. King George was perhaps more interested in collecting great music than really appreciating it, and he had rather conservative tastes, as you'll hear. So a name that keeps cropping up is, of course, Handel.
Thank you.
Paul McCreesh conducting the Gabrieli Consort in the Allegro from the opening symphony to Handel's oratorio Saul, composed when King George III was just a baby. Now, if you heard our first Georgian programme when I took a sort of virtual walk round landmarks of London's West End, today's a bit different, with a real visit to a part of London that had barely got going when George III reigned, King's Cross. My destination was the British Library, where I joined Nicholas Bell, curator of music collections there, Handel Authority Professor Donald Burrows of the Open University, and a tempting stack of leather-bound music manuscripts and books. The first obvious topic, what is the Royal Music Library? How did it come into being?
Well, the Royal Music Library is one small component of the music collections here at the British Library. Only a few thousand books out of the millions that constitute the collections. But in many ways, it's the jewel in the crown of our music collections. The collection as it is now was formed by George III and later monarchs, especially Queen Victoria. There's very little from the period before George III.
So the man who, or the king, I should say, who really put it on the map as a collection was George III. We owe him a lot.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. George I and George II were both musical as well, but George III really expanded the collections into older music as well as music of his own time and formed it as a separately constituted music library.
Well, Donald, if I can bring you in, Donald Burrows, what did George III have to work on when he started making the Royal Music Library what it is today?
I think only a collection that had come from King George II and his queen, mainly music that had come from Hanover with King George I. The manuscripts that we can trace back to that are operas and duets by Stefani.
Could we have a look at one of the attractively bound volumes that's over on the trolley? Donald, you go and choose one.
Right, OK.
Yes,
here
I go. I'm very interested in the fact that it is obviously so very beautifully bound, there's lots of gold knocking about, but it's very fragile. The spine looks very delicate.
Yes, that's true. This is one of Stefani's operas, and it's an original binding from the Hanoverian time, from the end of the 17th century. And many of the later manuscripts in this collection we have repaired and rebound over the years. But these manuscripts we've kept in their original bindings for reasons that you can see on the front cover, in fact.
Its origins in Hanover are apparent from the fact that it has the Hanover horse on the front and on the back the picture of